Good morning and welcome to Talk at 10 with your host, Joan Bryden. Talk at 10 is heard every weekday at 10 a.m. and features guests and interviews from local government officials, those excelling in the arts, specialists in health and well-being, and local experts with information to make your everyday life easier. Now here's Joan with Talk at 10 here on WPCR PortClintonRadio.com.
Good morning and welcome to WPCR, PortClintonRadio.com. I'm Joan Bryden, your host of Talk at 10. And on today's Friday edition of Talk at 10, I have with me an author named Ann Werner. And Ann has two books out, Dreams for Stones and Persistence of Dreams. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Thank you, Joan.
And my first question would be, why dreams with both the titles in both of these books?
Well, in part, I use that because the two books are interconnected. And so I tried to find a title for the second book that showed that it was connected as a sequel to the first book.
Did you intend to have that done when you began the first book, Dreams for Stone? When you were writing, did you intend to be writing a sequel to follow?
No, I did not. Actually, the way that the sequel came about was that I had a critique group I was working with, and one of my critique partners finished Dreams for Stones, and then she said to me, you know, I really would like to see how these characters, Alan and Kathy, handle married life. And I sat there for a few minutes and thought about it and decided, you know, that would be interesting. Sat down and began writing the book. However, once I started writing, I found that although those two characters, Kathy and Alan, did appear throughout the second book, the second book actually became the story of Charles Larimer, who was a minor character in the first book.
Mm-hmm. And the best friend of Alan's, correct?
And the best friend of Alan, right.
Right. And I wanted our listeners to know, too, that that you also received the Indy Next Generation Book Award finalist. And for those who don't know what the Indy Next Generation Book Award is, could you explain what that is?
Yes, this is given by a group that is focused on trying to support and promote books that are published by smaller publishers, the indie publisher movement. And in particular, they focus on publishers that publish books electronically.
Now, I noticed that you live in Cincinnati and you've been there for 24 or 5 years, correct?
Correct.
But you've been sounds like you've been to quite a numerous amount of locations throughout your life. Is that why you put Cincinnati in one of the books as well? I mean, do you write about some of the areas you've been, although don't think I saw anything about Puerto Rico.
Actually, there is a scene in Puerto Rico.
Oh, is there? Okay.
The novel. Yes, well, part of the reason that Cincinnati appears in that book is because one of the storylines is a set of diaries from an elderly woman, and she lived in Cincinnati. And that's actually based on a friend of mine. This is a couple that my husband and I met when we first moved to Cincinnati back in 1985, and this couple was in their 80s at that time, and we became very good friends and heard a lot of the stories of their lives. And that story became the diaries that I wrote for Dreams for Stones.
Okay. And dreams in themselves mean something to you, it sounds like, as well.
Yes. Well, a dream was what started me off writing. I had no idea that I was going to start writing. I had a very busy job for over 30 years. I was a professor and a clinical chemist and toxicologist, and that took up a lot of my time. And because of some things that were happening in the situation here in Cincinnati, my position was being moved and actually eliminated. And that gave me more time all of a sudden to think about things other than just the work I had been doing. And I woke up one morning from a dream of a woman standing next to a lake. And I sat down and began writing to find out who she was and what she was doing there.
Well, that's interesting that you didn't just, excuse the pun, but write it off as just a dream. I mean, it actually moved you. You took note of it and paid attention to that dream then, it sounds like.
Yes, yes.
And is that why the cover of Dreams for Stone has the lake in the picture
yes.
as well?
Yes, that is a key area that is seen in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's image of where a number of the important scenes take place. And so I had a very clear idea in my mind what that should look like, and had to work back and forth quite a bit with the cover artist to get that right.
Well, it was quite a stretch, it sounds like, to go from a scientist to a novelist. Or did you always write, other than for professional reasons, did you always have kind of the want to write, or did you do that on the side a little bit?
You know, I didn't. I've always enjoyed writing, but my writing up until about 10 years ago was scientific papers, memos, course notes, all that sort of thing. And what I found when I started writing fiction was that it's a very different animal. I was lucky that I had the advantage of having a good grasp of grammar and of spelling, you know, the basics. But what I discovered was that to put words together to tell a story is a very different skill, and one that it took me a number of years to develop. I started out, you know, my very first manuscript was pretty bad. And once I discovered that, I started going to seminars and workshops and reading books about writing fiction, and developing the skills that I needed.
Well, that was very brave of you to make such a career switch. And as you said, the first one you felt was, you know, it wasn't up to par, but yet you didn't give up. I mean, that says a lot about the character of who you are as well.
If you're going to be a published writer, that is one of the key things. You can't give up.
Yeah.
Because you'll automatically, absolutely guarantee that you won't succeed if you stop.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say in Dreams for Stones, just in the dedication alone, you mentioned your husband before. I think that what you wrote to your husband, if you'd like to read it, I don't know if that's in front of you. I was so moved just by that itself.
How are you? Yes, I do have it.
Okay.
To my husband who loves me for ordinary reasons in an extraordinary way.
That is just so beautiful. So you know that at least I felt that we were going to experience quite a depth of love and compassion in your characters right off the bat, if you, the novelist, already has that in their makeup and feels that way about their husband. I thought that was beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Sure, sure. Well, tell me about Dreams of Stones. We'll start with that, and then in a little bit I'd ask you to read a little bit from it. What would you like the listeners to know about that book?
Well, it's set in Colorado, mostly in Denver and on a ranch south of Denver, and it's actually several stories woven together. The main characters are Kathy and Alan. Alan is a professor of literature at Denver State University, and his family owns a ranch where they raise Pasofinos, which is a gated-type horse. His wife died 5 years earlier when they were on a trip to Alaska, and Alan is having difficulty getting over her loss. Mm-hmm. Kathy is a children's book editor, and she works at Calico Cat Books, and she's engaged to another man when the story begins. And when her fiancé ends that engagement, she's left bruised and uncertain of her ability to choose wisely. So that's the one story thread. A second story thread is the story of Jess and Emily. Emily is an elderly woman whom Kathy met during her college years in Cincinnati. And when Emily dies, Jess gives Kathy Emily's diaries. And Jess and Emily, their story is that they had a son, Bobby, who had meningitis before the days of antibiotics, and although he survived, he was left an invalid, had to be cared for all of his life. Well, Emily's diaries will help Kathy as she navigates through her own difficulties, and they eventually inspire her to write a children's story that's based on Bobby's life. And that's one of the catalysts that's going to serve to help her and Alan reconcile and
so,
find a way to love each other.
Were you a bit of Kathy? And was the Emily storyline come from the elderly couple that you said you and your husband
met? Yes, but I think Kathy is, I think bits and pieces of the author are in absolutely everything you write, whether you intend it or not. Because I did give Kathy also a background as coming from a military family, which I do.
Right, right.
So, yes, there are bits and pieces of autobiographical things, and yet this story is not my story.
But yet, when you know, I was thinking that when you said bits of the writer is always in the novels, or I would think all the characters, because you're writing from a consciousness that you are in that moment. That's who you're. Their voice is speaking through you. And I always find it interesting when an author will say, well, no, it's not nobody I know. I find that very hard to believe that if you're writing that there's not something that's coming from a subconscious and conscious level that is part of who you are, whether it's a male or a female in the story.
Right. You know? Well, I think you're right. I think that everybody has a filter. And, mm-hmm. you know, our filter looking at the world is based on our entire experience of that world and all the people we've met and all the experiences that we've had. And you can't necessarily turn that off. And so I think that's why each author's voice sounds different, because that's their unique way of looking at the world.
Sure, your perception. Now, do you find that writing was a way to fulfill some of your dreams? And what I mean by that is, I believe I read somewhere where you said you always wanted to marry a rich rancher and own a racehorse, and I think you said your husband doesn't even like horses, and you live in Cincinnati. Not that you couldn't have a racehorse there, that's for sure, but but do you think that's a way to fulfill some of the dreams that you've had?
I think it was kind of a fun thing to do, in a way, to go ahead and put the horses and the ranch in, and the Colorado setting, which is one of my favorite places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think as long as when you're writing a book, you're God, really. You know, you create whatever world you want, put whatever people you want to into it. And so in that way, yeah, it probably is a dream fulfillment.
You also state that dreams never completely go away, but continue to influence our lives in unexpected ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think once you get that, you stop trying to block those dreams, and I think that the whole creative process switches for a person, or acceptance, or lack of fear, or whatever. When you accept that, I like what you said with that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, as far as going from a scientist to a novelist, let's talk a little bit about your everyday life with that. So you went from the writings that you did. Right, or things you did write were more for your university, for work and so on. When you sat down to write Dreams of Four Stones, did you handle yourself the same way, like you're going to a 8-to-5 job or whatever? Did you, the same kind of discipline?
Yes, actually I did. Because that was what I was used to.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left the university and came home and started writing, I had a particular place in the house where I come to work. And there is, I think after you've done it a few times, there is a switch that goes on, and the subconscious knows, well, we're going downstairs, we're going to the office, and we're going to work. And that had always worked for me in my regular job, obviously. You know, you go off to work, you could arrive at your office, you sit down at your desk, and you get into the mode of working. And so the same thing has held true for me in my writing. I think some writers who are forced to write part-time,
mm-hmm.
they have to use other techniques, because they just have to grab those 10, 15, 30-minute little blocks of time that they have,
mm-hmm.
wherever they happen to be, to add to their books. So I was really lucky to be able to turn my attention, my full-time attention to it.
What did your family think when you, or your husband, when you said, okay, you know, I was a scientist, I was working at the university and so on, and now, hey, I think I'm going to be a novelist. Did they say what? or did they see that process beginning?
You know, the process began before I left the university, because what happened here was that I was at the University of Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
In the university hospital, and directing one of the laboratories. And a number of hospitals formed a consortium,
mm-hmm.
and the laboratories that I was directing was actually closed, and all of the techs were moved. And I still had a contract, and I was doing some teaching, a little bit of research, but I wasn't as busy as I had been. And that was when I actually began doing a bit of the writing during the time that, you know, there was nothing else calling on my attention. And I was being offered another position in a different department, to shift to when my contract was up. And it would have been a half-time position. And by the time I got to that point of making that decision, I realized I didn't even want to be interrupted half-time. I wanted my full day to be able to do what I had just discovered I thoroughly enjoyed doing.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband was very supportive of that.
Absolutely, no.
Oh, my God, what are you doing to us? No, nothing like that.
Were you surprised when you finished the book and it was actually published? Were you surprised that it was, or did you always feel as though, well, of course it's going to be a published piece of work?
I was thrilled.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'd say I was surprised, because I think I knew from the point that I finished the first book and realized this is something I can do and I love doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I decided at that point, I'm sticking with this. And come thick or thin, I'm going to make it. And you have to have that attitude, quite frankly, if you're going to become published in the world right now.
Well, I guess it's a matter of feeling as though you have that skill and believing in yourself.
Yes, there's that too.
Yeah.
And that is a process. You know, I read somewhere recently that it takes about 10,000 hours to actually develop a new skill, whether it's painting or playing an instrument or writing.
Hmm.
And I think I have followed that apprenticeship of about 10,000 hours, which is, you know, 20 hours a week or 30 hours a week spread over a 10-year time frame. And that's what it has taken me to really hone my craft and be good enough to publish.
I've never heard that before. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you find yourself that you would, did you make sure you wrote every day, even if you didn't feel like it, or even if you didn't think you had something to put down on paper?
Yes, I do try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not able to write new things, then I will go back and look at things that I've already written and work on revising.
Yeah. Now, again, in Dreams for Stones, you talk about some very emotional issues, whether it was Alan or Kathleen or Meg, and then, like you said, you touched on Charles and that. Are those things that you, as a writer, felt you had some knowledge about that you wanted to share or solve for yourself or for someone else?
I think what struck me, the what if that started the Dreams for Stone story was when my husband and I were visiting in Alaska one time and read in the newspaper about a young couple who were caught in the tidal flat area of Turnagain Arm, and the wife was trapped and she drowned.
Mm-hmm.
And I that just stuck with me. I all I could think about was, how is that man going to go forward with his life after this horrific experience? And I wrote this story in part to answer that question for myself. I think that it is a mystery to all of us humans as to how do we get through those kinds of things. And some people obviously don't make it through difficult events. But others of us manage to find a way to live with the hard things that have happened, the sad things that have happened, and to be happy again. And I think that was part of my reason for wanting to write this, was to see, could I discover how that could potentially happen?
Now, to get a male's perspective, did you talk with males, or did you just use your own as you thought he would handle it?
I did a little bit of both. I have actually, one of my critique partners is a psychologist and a male,
mm-hmm.
and he was very helpful.
Oh, okay. Now, you say critique partners. Is this part of a writing group that you belong to?
Yes. I personally have found it very helpful when I'm writing a book, or actually after I've written a book, to then take it to friends who are writers and have them read and critique it and tell me whether I am achieving what I'm trying to achieve. I mean, many times the author, you know, has a very clear picture of the characters and who they are and why they do things, and sometimes we fail to put everything we need to on the page for the reader. And so having people who will read the book before it is published and to comment on it is a great help to an author.
Now, these writers, would they be published and unpublished?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if some of them are friends or coworkers, where's the fine line of, well, she said I didn't do this or that with the character development, but I don't truly believe that. How do you sort that out? Or maybe she really doesn't want me to be published, or he doesn't, or something. And the reason I ask all these sort of questions is because I think it's real interesting and also helpful for people who want to write, that whenever I have the opportunity to talk with an author who's willing to share these writing skills and ideas and the way that you sit down to write, I think that helps everybody to grow. But I've had a few people say, well, you know, I wasn't sure if he was telling me that because all of a sudden mine's looking a little better than his. So how do you sort that out?
Well, the way I've done it is, in part, it's my gut feeling.
Uh-huh.
And if I walk away from a critique session feeling energized and with new ideas spinning, then I know I've got a critique partner that's worth hanging on to.
Okay.
And when you're going into a critique, you're not asking people to say, oh, this is the best thing I've ever read.
Uh-huh.
In fact, at that point in time, before something is published, what I really do want is for them to say, you know, this point right here, this didn't work for me, or this character acted out of character here. It's, you know, it, that sort of thing. I want to know those things. And so I do really want a critique.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to listen carefully and observe how the person is doing it, and to have some sense of that person, so that you are working with people who have your best interests in heart, whose critiques are coming from an honest desire to help a fellow writer. And I think you can pick up on that. If you've got somebody, you know, if you walk away from a critique and you're just feeling kind of, chances are that that's not the right partner for you. And you don't find just one. I mean, I have been a member of multiple critique groups at various times. And the more input you can get from people who actually know about writing, the better off you're going to be.
Sure, sure.
But the other thing that can happen is, of course, you can have two or three people reading it, and one say one thing, and the other say exactly the opposite. And some authors do get caught up in that, well, I changed it to this, and then they told me to change it back to that. And, you know, you can get into a real ping-pong match with your work, and what you have to remember always is it's your work, and you have to follow your gut
right.
on what's the right thing to do here. But listen to what people have to say with as open a mind as possible.
Sure. And I assume that would be a little tough in some cases, because I can only imagine that the words that you put on your paper become almost like your children.
Yes.
And it would be like somebody saying, well, I don't like what you've done with that child. So
you have to kind of let go of that.
Sure, sure. Well, Anne, before we move on to Persistence of Dreams, would you mind reading a little bit from Dreams for Stones for our listeners?
Certainly, I'd be happy to.
Great.
What I'm going to do, this is a scene after Kathy and Alan have developed their relationship, but then Alan has broken it off. And in the aftermath, he finally begins to take steps to deal with his grief. And one of those steps is to visit his wife's grave.
Okay.
So here's the scene. It took him 30 minutes to find Meg's grave. All he remembered from the day they buried her was looking up from the gravesite and seeing the small hill with its tall tree, the mountains behind, solid, eternal, aloof from earthly sorrow. He stood looking down at the gray granite marker. Margaret Adams Francini, Meg, 1966 to 1993. They'd asked him what to put on the stone. He told them to put any damn thing they pleased. Be not afraid. His breath caught in surprise. He and Meg had been in eighth grade, Elaine in ninth. Bet you guys don't have a clue what words appear most often in the Bible, Meg had said. Of course we don't. We're Catholics, Elaine said. See, and, but, Alan said. Oh, and begat. Meg had taken a playful swipe at him, which made his horse pretend to shy, and Elaine's horse to flick its ears and snort. Think you're so smart, huh? Meg said, grinning at him. Then her look turned serious. Be not afraid. 365 times, just to make sure we get it. How cool is that? What's to get, he asked. Meg shook her head, giving him her boys or hopeless look. That we don't have to worry. Just do our best and everything will turn out okay. Etc. except it hadn't. Without Meg, he'd lost it all. Tears, words, joy. He stood bent over Meg's grave, and the memory slipped out, floating away like clouds laden with rain heading for the plains. He looked again at Meg's marker. It was unpretentious, just like Meg. The only decoration was an anemone, the first spring flower curved along one side. He glanced around at the artificial flowers on several of the graves and real flowers in plastic vases, browning and dropping their petals on others. Should he bring flowers to Meg? She had loved flowers, the wildflowers best of all, the anemones, columbines, buttercups, and fireweed. But pick a wildflower and it dies within a day. No, this was better. A simple marker with its plain patch of grass. And that's the scene.
Very nice. And in order to let our listeners know as well, Dreams for Stones as well as Persistence of Dreams are available at most bookstores, correct?
They are, and they are available at Book Exchange in Port Clinton.
Exactly. And Amazon as well?
Amazon, correct.
Okay.
BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, terrific. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back in, we'll talk a little bit more then on the sequel, which is Persistence of Dreams. So
okay.
We'll be right back.
Terra Community College presents Holiday Festival 2009, Holiday of Hope. Featuring renowned actress and jazz artist Joyce Carolyn, the Terra Choral and Brass Ensembles with Michael Schertz and Jeff Blanchard conductors. The Terra Community College music program promises to be the perfect start to celebrating the holiday season with the whole family. Join us for the musical event of the season on Friday, December 4th, 7:30 p.m. at the Sandusky State Theater. Saturday, December 5th, 7:30 p.m. at the Port Clinton Performing Arts Center. And Sunday, December 6th, 4 p.m. at the Grace Lutheran Church in Fremont. Admission is just $10 and only $8 for seniors and students. For tickets and information, contact 419-559-2233 or by email at music@terra.edu. You may also visit www.terra.edu for a complete concert schedule as we celebrate the Holiday of Hope from Terra Community College.
Secure, comfortable, real. Come home to your community banker. First National Bank has been serving our community for over 133 years. Community banks are strong, safe, secure, and stable financial institutions focused on doing what is best for our customers and our communities. Come home to the people you know. We won't disappoint you. Visit us in Bellevue, Catawba, Put-in Bay, Port Clinton, and Sandusky, or online at fnblifetime.com. First National Bank. We go where life takes you, member FDIC.
Take the stress out of buying your next car or truck. At Spangler Motor Sales, we offer a hometown atmosphere and a low-pressure deal from our professional staff designed to get you into the vehicle of your choice. Our certified used car program offers you the comfort of knowing that your vehicle has passed our stringent requirements for quality and is backed by our full warranty protection plan. Can't find the car you want? Let us look for you. Our Express Locator service will find exactly the make, model, and year vehicle of your choice and is available to everyone. For sales, service, and parts, it's Spangler Motor Sales. 121 South Locust Street in downtown Oak Harbor. Open Monday and Thursday, 8 to 8. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, 9 to 6. And Saturdays, 9 to 1. Spangler Motor Sales, your hometown dealer since 1960.
Welcome back. Again, I'm Joan Bryden, host of Talk at 10. And with me today on our Friday's edition is Ann Warner. And in our second segment here, we're going to talk about her sequel to Dreams for Stones, and this book is called Persistence of Dreams. Anne, you said that the book is readily available and certainly here in Port Clinton at the Book Exchange, correct?
Correct.
And I believe Annette has some autographed copies there as well. So,
yes, she does.
Yeah, so great. When did you start writing Persistence of Dreams? Did you begin that before you even finished Dreams for Stones?
No, I had already finished Dreams for Stones and actually written a couple of other books before I did Persistence of Dreams.
Really?
Yes.
And so what made you do that then? What made you write Persistence of Dreams?
Well, this was the one that in response to the critique partner saying she wanted to see more of Kathy and Alan and how particularly Alan would cope with married life. And so I sat down and actually this book I wrote in less than a year, which is unusual for me. It usually takes me 2 or 3 years to to finish a book.
So this critique partner wanted to know how Alan also dealt with the grief of losing his wife and how that ended up?
Correct, and how he dealt now with falling in love with another woman.
Did you find people that read Dreams for Stones, did you find people wanting more? I mean, asking you, well, about how he dealt with the grief and how does one get through this and that sort of thing?
Well, what I have received are notes, a couple of notes from women who had lost their husbands, who found the book very, very helpful to them. I had one woman tell me that she found the book romantic and emotional,
mm-hmm.
But that she'd read a lot of books on grief and what one must go through. But this story became for her a step-by-step way of facing grief and coping with it.
Huh.
And it helped her to accept her grief finally after 10 years. And that really, that did surprise me, to have that reaction.
Yeah, I imagine, and that's interesting, too. It seems like that would be a safer way to maybe work with your raw emotions as well.
Mm-hmm.
You said, this woman said she read numerous books over 10 years on how to deal with grief, but by putting it in a novel takes it maybe one step removed from you feeling every bit of that so intensely or feeling as though you have to do it this way. It seems to me that by reading in a novel how someone handled it, gave her some ideas or some wisdom in that.
That appears to be her reaction. And she said that when she first started reading the book and realizing it was a story about a widower, she wasn't sure she was going to read it.
Yeah. Huh. So you decided then to write Persistence of Dreams.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And did that pick up where Dreams for Stones left off?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact. And as I said, it is. It focuses primarily on Charles Larimer, who is Alan's best friend. And in Dreams for Stones, poor Charles, he falls in love with Kathy as well. And when he discovers that Kathy and Alan are estranged but in love with each other, he makes the choice to help them get together. And that's a choice that has left him, of course, with a broken heart.
Hmm.
So the beginning of Persistence of Dreams is a rewrite of the last scene between Kathy and Charles that appears at the end of Dreams for Stones.
I see.
I just changed the point of view. In the one book, it's in Kathy's point of view. In the new book, it's Charles' point of view.
Okay.
Now, Charles is a deputy district attorney in Denver, and a couple of things about him that are important for the story to know is that he has an ironclad rule that he never dates a woman who has children, and he's afraid of horses. So, of course, he's going to end up with a woman with both. Possibly children, or who appears
funny
to have children.
That sounds like a kind of a common thread that runs in your writing in regards to the things that you think you want, and then you pick just the opposite, but then how do you sort it out?
Yes, exactly. Well, I think that happens to all of us in life, doesn't it?
Well, if you're awake enough to notice that, or, seriously, I don't mean that in a negative way, but if you are actually taking note of that instead of just kind of going through life, I mean, I think there's lots of people who maybe, like you said, they handle things differently, and I think there are people who maybe just stay kind of in a one state of thinking and don't challenge.
Mm-hmm. Sleepwalkers.
Some of it. Yeah, really, really, really. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about Persistence of Dreams without giving too much away.
Oh, okay. Well, as I said, Charles is the deputy district attorney, and he is burned out of his apartment by an arsonist that he previously prosecuted. And so he has to move into this slightly seedy apartment as an interim measure while he's recovering all his stuff. And he discovers his next-door neighbor is a woman named Luce, and she appears to have two children. And he eventually learns that they are not her children, that they are her siblings, and that she is wanted by the authorities. And so that puts him in a very difficult position because, of course, as a district attorney, an officer of the court, it's his role to report her. On the other hand, as he learns more about her, he discovers that perhaps she has done the right thing in running away.
So she's running away because she has the children and that's why she's wanted?
Yeah, she ran away because her parents were killed in an auto accident, and she was in college, and she came home for the funeral, and her step-uncle came over after the funeral and basically said your brother and sister are going into foster care.
Oh, okay.
And that there was no money left by your parents. And he convinces Luce that she has no other things that she can do to stop that except to run away with the children.
I see. Is there a section of Persistence of Dreams you'd like to read for our listeners?
Certainly. I have three short scenes that I can read, and the first one introduces Luce.
Okay.
Luce made it through the funeral in the days that it descended on her when her step-aunt's phone call. Her parents dead in an auto accident, so abruptly and unbelievably that she still didn't totally believe it, except some part of her must be beginning to accept because the world had turned dark and frightening. She longed to lock herself in her room, huddle under the covers, and give in to the grief that had wrapped around her so tightly she wondered why she was still able to move. When she responded to the words of condolence, her voice sounded odd, as if her words were coming from a deep, hollow place. People hugged her and their tears wet her cheeks, but she refused to cry. The only thing forcing a normality she no longer believed in were her brother and sister. Marisol, only 6, had some inkling, although she still didn't really understand she was never going to see Mommy and Papi again. But Carlito, still an infant, had no idea what had happened. He still gurgled and smiled when she picked him up. She made sure he was fed and dry, washed and clothed, hugged and cooed back at, surprised she could manage it. For Marisol and Carlito's sake, she pretended everything was going to be okay, and she was beginning to hope that might eventually be true when her step-uncle Martin Blair stopped by the house 2 days after the funeral. And we have a next scene that shows Charles after he's burned out of his apartment by an arsonist and is forced to move into another more run-down apartment. Drip, 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 drip. Charles glared at the kitchen faucet. If it would just find a steady rhythm and stick with it, he could ignore it. It was the sudden rifts that kept snagging his attention. He turned back to the papers littering the tabletop, a list he was preparing for the insurance company of everything he'd owned at the time of the fire. He was finding it surprisingly difficult in spite of his ability to remember details. Items kept floating into his mind, trailing regrets that distracted him, like the t-shirts from his Iron Man competitions. They were all in pretty ratty shape, but they were what he'd worn when he went jogging as a reminder of what he was capable of when he put his mind to it. He hadn't competed for 5 years, and these days he'd have a hard time finishing a half Iron Man, which made the shirts irreplaceable, not something he could easily attach a price to for the insurance company. And it was no easier to attach a dollar figure to the contents of the small clay bowl he'd bought in Santa Fe. He kept it by his bed to hold the stones he picked up each time he managed to get out of the city to ride or run in the mountains. It was a way of keeping track, he supposed. They were nothing special, simply ordinary bits of gravel he'd found on the trails, but they meant something to him. Sometimes he'd held the bowl in his hand, feeling the smoothness the potter had worked into the clay. And if it had been a particularly difficult week, he would pour the stones into his hand and remember the pull of muscle and sinew, the labor of lungs and heart they represented. There had been no stones added since he lost Kathy.
Your characters certainly are kind-hearted and emotional type of people, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I also read somewhere, and I think it's very true, that the only characters worth writing about are those that are at the end of their ropes.
Ah. Now, is there a sequel to Persistence of Dreams, or do you feel as though you've ended it where you needed to end it?
I think I've ended it where I need to end it, and I'm not planning any further sequels at this point.
And you said you have other books out, or you've been working on some other books?
I have other books that I'm working on.
Right. So you work on a few at the same time?
Well, I usually, first draft, I usually focus on just one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
But then once I get a first draft done, it still takes a while for me to discover everything I need to discover about those characters. Mm. I know what the story is now, but then I discover the deeper layers that need to be added in.
I see. So you have to live with these people for a little while.
Yes,
What is your next book? Is it a novel again?
Yes. I'm continuing to write novels.
And will it be located in one of the places that you either love or have lived in?
I have one novel that is set in Wrangell, Alaska, actually.
Okay. And you said you've been to Alaska, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I have another one that is partly set in Australia and New Zealand.
And you've been there as well, right?
Yes, correct.
Now, when you write from different, you know, in different areas of the world, do you find that you really have to do a lot of research in regards to the way the people that would respond to things? I mean, I know there's so many basics for all of us humans, but do you find that you have to switch things a little bit? And I don't just mean by the words, but maybe how people react to things?
I do. I actually, one of the things that I have published is a short story, and it shows an American woman who has develops a relationship with an Aussie man. And one of my favorite notes from somebody who read that story was from an Aussie woman who said that really sounded like an Aussie man. So that was a delight to know that I had succeeded in that.
Did you draw that from when you were in Australia then?
Yes. Well, you know, from being in the country and reading the newspapers and Australian friends. And there is, you know, there is a different way of approaching things that's sort of an Aussie way.
Uh-huh.
And it was a lot of fun to play with that.
Sure.
That story.
Well, that sounds like some great advice as well to people who are considering being writers. But it sounds like what you're telling people to do is you really have to do your research.
Yes. Yes, you do. And, of course, the Internet makes a lot of that easy.
Uh-huh.
You can actually go on the Internet, of course, and look at locations. But I think it is very important if you can possibly spend a little bit of time there, even if it's, you know, just a few days,
mm-hmm.
To get a feel for what it feels like to be in that location so that you can express that in the writing.
Right, right. Now, if any of our listeners would like to contact you or to find out how you went about getting a critique partner and so on, is there an email address or a website that people could go to?
Absolutely. I think the easiest thing is to give them my website, because then there's a contact page on the website, and it's www.ann.warner.net.
That's easy enough. And can they also find ways to order your books that way?
Yes, the links for ordering the books are located on the website.
Okay, great. So what's next for Ann Warner?
Well, I'm going to continue to write.
Uh-huh.
I would like to find another publisher. The publisher I'm with at the moment is focusing really more on the romance genre,
mm-hmm.
and my novels are more women's fiction, and so I'm going to need to find a new publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be a lot of work, as I know from past experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also just continuing to write my stories.
So you don't let the fact that you're going to have to do quite a bit of work to find, like you said, maybe go that whole route of finding another publisher, such as women's publishers, it doesn't get in the way of what you're writing at the time?
It can't, because, frankly, Joan, when you're in this process of trying to get published, it's a very lengthy process, and you send out your queries or you send out work that has been requested, and you can wait weeks or even months to get responses. And so if you start arranging your schedule so that you're waiting for something to come in, and before you do the next step, you're just going to sit around most of the time.
Yeah, sure.
So you just have to send things out and forget about them and continue working on the work.
Sounds like great advice. Do you ever regret having changed careers?
I do not.
Yeah.
I was totally surprised at how much I loved what I was doing before. I thought they were going to carry me out. but I love this even more. I'm having so much fun. And so, no, I don't regret it. I miss, you know, the coworkers.
Mm-hmm.
But that was already gone already anyway because of the changes that have occurred. So no, I don't miss that.
Were your coworkers, any of them, surprised by the change in careers?
I think so. Yes.
Uh-huh. Have you had any feedback from them?
Yes, and it's been delightful to hear from them. You know, when you put a book out, it is putting out a piece of yourself, and if people don't like it, and not everybody's going to,
mm-hmm.
we all have different tastes. I think that can affect the relationship. But luckily, most of my friends and family have thoroughly enjoyed my books and have told me so.
Have they asked
very
you?
Sincerely?
Oh, that's great. And have they asked you if so and so is a little bit of them, or did you think of me when you wrote that? Did you get that at all?
No, actually, I haven't.
Oh, maybe they're waiting for you to say, "Oh, by the way, you're a little bit like Meg, or you're a little bit like Charles."
Yeah, possibly.
But, yeah. Well, any last minute information that you'd like to give our listeners?
Well, I think my advice to anybody who is thinking about writing is if you can avoid it, maybe that best thing to do would be to avoid it, because if you take up writing, there's going to be a lot of joy and pleasure in doing it, but there's also going to be a lot of rejection and it's going to take a lot of persistence, really, to end up published. It's not an easy thing to become published in this day and age, having gone that route, I'm so glad that I stuck with it, and I have thoroughly enjoyed having published novels out there, and I love opening my email and discovering a comment from a reader.
Okay.
It's a high of a very special type.
That's neat, yeah. And it sure sounds like what you're also telling people to do is believe in yourself. That's probably going to be the first step,
and
you need to have
what,
that belief.
You know, follow your bliss, I guess, is the
great
way it's been put.
Well, Anne, we look forward to reading the next novels you have out, so make sure you get a hold of me here, and we'll have to do an interview again.
Thank you so much, Joan.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for being on Talk at 10. Also, I'd like to let our listeners know if you missed part of this show, or if you want to hear it in its entirety or at a different time, or what do I suppose to say? Well, if you want to hear it again, I should say, then make sure you go to www.portclintonradio.com and just click on Listen on Demand. And with that, I'd like to thank you, Anne, for being on our show, and continued success.
Thank you so much, Joan.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Talk at 10. Make sure you join us Monday through Friday for Talk at 10 with Joan Bryden, right here on WPCR, portclintonradio.com.